The Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order, and I will note this meeting is taking place under House Rule 10.01. Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll.
Chair Houseman?
Present.
Houseman, present. Vice Chair Howard? Representative Tice?
Tice here.
Tice here. Representative Egbadje?
Present.
Egbadje, present. Representative Bliss? Representative Gomez?
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Representative Hassan?
Hassan is present.
Hassan, present. Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Herr?
Present.
Herr, present. Representative Juergens?
Juergens, present.
Juergens, present. Representative Olson?
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Farr? Representative Breyer?
Breyer, present.
Breyer, present. And then we'll go back to Vice Chair Howard.
Howard, present.
Howard, present. And Representative Farr?
Present.
Farr, present. And Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. The next item of business is approval of the minutes for Tuesday, March 1. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review those minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move the minutes.
Members, any corrections? Seeing none, if you would unmute yourselves, all those in favor of approval of the minutes say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, today's agenda focuses on important policy changes to Minnesota's landlord-tenant law. All the bills are chief authored by Representative Herr, so we're going to work her very hard today. The first on the agenda is House File 835, and the chair moves that House File 835 be laid over. Representative Herr, please proceed with your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Houseman and committee members, for dedicating this entire hearing today for tenant protection bills. Before I speak to the first bill, I want to say that I believe that housing is one of the most important issues of our time. Housing sits at the intersection of the disparities we face in economic, wealth, education, jobs, and health. Many of you have heard me say this before, and I'm sure maybe you might be tired of hearing me continue to say this, but I believe that it is worth repeating. If someone doesn't have safe, affordable, and stable housing, they cannot secure a job, they can't build wealth, kids can't study, and they can't do well in school, and then people can't manage their health. I do want to acknowledge that for the most part, landlords try to work with their tenants. The landlords who already do these bills today have no impact on them. However, because landlords write the leases, there is an imbalance of power. To level out the playing field, the law, in addition to outlining the parameters for tenants and landlords, must also include specific rights and protections for tenants. It's important to note that Minnesota's tenant-landlord law, as Chair Houseman stated, has not received serious revisions for decades. Dedicating one hearing for these bills shows the commitment this committee has for the issue and bringing Minnesota in line with numerous states who already have similar language in statute. Chair and members, the first bill on the agenda is House File 835, and this bill is a housing policy proposal related to tenants' rights. The bill has four parts. And Chair, I can go over each part in detail, or I can just kind of talk briefly, but each one, which would you prefer, Chair Houseman?
I think briefly, and then if there are questions later that require more explanation, but I think briefly.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. So the first section is banning housing discrimination based on public assistance. That's section 1-3 and makes additions to the Human Rights Act to ban source of income discrimination in relations to housing. The second one is, I just want to state that for this one, there are already 17 states, this is already in law, 17 states and over 90 localities nationwide. The next section is eviction expanded, and that's section 4 and 5, which expands eligibility for eviction expungement. Right now, eviction filings immediately go on a tenant's record and remain there even if a case is decided in their favor. An eviction record can follow an individual for years and interfere their ability to have access to stable housing. And so it would require a court to order an expungement if the following under the following circumstances. One, the defendant wins their case. Two, the case is dismissed. Three, the parties have agreed to an expungement. Four, the eviction is more than 3 years old. Or five, the case is settled and defendant fulfills the terms of the settlement, which all seem to me very common sense, especially when there is agreement or there is no judgment. The next section is pre-eviction notice required. In Minnesota, evictions can be filed without a tenant's knowledge once they are filed. In general, it can take up to 10 days from filing to trial. This leaves little chance for a tenant to try to remedy their situation by paying past due rent to avoid evictions. This provision provides landlords the same standard Minnesota already requires for a tenant who must themselves wait 14 days for a landlord to fail to respond to a written repair notice before they're allowed to file a lawsuit. So this just gives tenants and landlords the same number of days. And then the last section is eviction filing non-public until judgment. That is section 7, and it makes eviction actions non-public data until the court enters a final judgment. Currently, eviction filings become public immediately, so individuals can have an eviction filing on their record, even if they ultimately win their case or have it dismissed. So that's my quick overview of each of the section. And with that, Madam Chair, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Herr. And members, all of these bills have already been heard in judiciary. And so one will be laid over and the other three do go to the general register. So to testifiers, the first one we have up is Shanna Tomenes from the Housing Justice Center. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Hausman. My name is Shanna Tomenes. I'm an Equal Justice Works Fellow at the Housing Justice Center. The Housing Justice Center is a nonprofit public interest advocacy and legal organization whose primary mission is to preserve and expand affordable housing for low-income individuals and families. I'm testifying today in support of the source of income protection portion of House File 835. This legislation is to protect individuals and families who are utilizing a voucher or a local subsidy to find housing. This bill most impacts the elderly, disabled, domestic violence victims, and low-income individuals and families in greater Minnesota. This legislation would not only fight the discrimination these people face, but would also allow Minnesota to use the resources in the localities and from the federal government more effectively to help more families find stable housing. In Minnesota, people currently wait months and sometimes years after qualifying for these programs and after filling out countless forms just to be told, okay, you have a voucher, go find a place to live. And then being told, no Section 8. Section 8 need not apply here. Sorry, no vouchers. It seems to be an empty promise for someone who's worked so hard. In anticipation of today's hearing, I went on Craigslist in my area, and out of the first 28 postings that I looked at, 13 of which had the words no Section 8 or sorry, no voucher in the language. And while that in of itself is shocking to me, I want to talk about the posting that I found from February 8th that was for looking for housing for in Freeport, Minnesota. This individual was seeking, said, someone, anyone, please help. It was a single mom who stated she was employed and had a Section 8 voucher and that she, quote, doesn't party and, quote, has good rental reference. And she just needed someone to accept her voucher in order to find housing, or she feared homelessness with her child. She said that she, quote, doesn't make any noise at all. And the only music she plays is when she's listening to the tunes while doing the dishes. For that reason, I urge you to adopt House File 835 to protect families seeking housing.
Thank you, Ms. Jimenez. And next we're joined by Leah DeGracia from Homeline. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hello, my name is Leah DeGracia. Thank you, Representative or Chair Hausman and members of the committee. My name is Leah DeGracia, and I am a housing attorney with Homeline, a nonprofit statewide tenant advocacy organization. Homeline's primary program is a hotline that any renter in Minnesota can contact to receive free and confidential legal advice about their rental situation. Since opening in 1992, we have advised over 275,000 renter households from every county in the state. We currently advise an average of 1,500 households each month from across the state, and our services are available in English, Spanish, Somali, and Hmong. Because of our work directly with tenants, we have unique insight into the issues facing many Minnesotan tenants and how the law could be changed to address these issues. We therefore urge this committee to move forward in support of House File 835 and also 398, 399, and 400. With regard to House File 835, which addresses needed eviction reform in the form of a pre-eviction notice, expungement reform, and discrimination based on source of income. Today, I will address pre-eviction notice and expungement reform. Prior to COVID-19, roughly 90% of all evictions in Minnesota were for the non-payment of rent. Once an eviction is filed, it immediately goes on a tenant's record unless it is expunged. However, Minnesota law creates no obligation on landlords to warn a tenant prior to filing an eviction in court and creating a public record. It is important to note that the majority of states already require some form of pre-eviction filing notice. Minnesota is in a very small minority, one of only four states with no such requirement. The majority of the country and even some Minnesota cities have recognized that such notices are good practice. Giving tenants a pre-eviction notice prior to filing an eviction for non-payment allows the tenant to pay any money owed, seek emergency financial aid, or simply decide to move rather than face an eviction on their record. Some landlords have adopted the practice of giving their tenants a pre-eviction notice, recognizing it as good business practice. For these landlords, this law would have very little effect, but this is not a consistent approach for all landlords. The reality is that pre-eviction notice isn't required. I have personally spoken to many tenants who received no notice prior to receiving their court summons, leaving them scrambling to figure out what resources are available to them. Rather than create a new hurdle for landlords, this proposal legitimizes the practices that many landlords already do, while also giving tenants protection from landlords who have not adopted these best business practices. Finally, a 14-day pre-eviction notice mirrors the required procedure already in place for when a landlord is in the breach of a lease. If a tenant has a problem with repairs or substandard living conditions in their home, they are required to provide their landlord with a 14-day written notice before filing a rent escrow court case. In our current system, the landlord has no obligation to warn the tenant that they will file a court case, despite the stakes being significantly higher than rent escrow. An eviction has a very real chance of making a renting family homeless and housing insecure for years. This 14-day pre-eviction notice makes this required communication reciprocal in order to help keep resolvable issues out of the court system. For all of the aforementioned reasons, we hope you will support a pre-eviction notice. The second important element of House File 835 is expungement reform. An eviction case is deemed public and can thus be seen on someone's record immediately once a case is filed. Though tenants must be formally served with eviction papers and have a chance to defend themselves in court before they can be actually removed from their home, the tenant must have the eviction officially expunged from their record even if the case is dismissed, the tenant prevails in court, or if a settlement is reached and honored. Such expungements are purely at the court's discretion, and many tenants do not have the legal training to navigate the system and argue for a discretionary expungement. House File 835 proposes some important changes to this system. First, an eviction action is not allowed to be a public record until the court has made a final decision in the case and determined that no mandatory expungements are required. Since there are multiple immediate situations where an expungement would be granted at the hearing, this change would prevent premature and prejudicial reporting. In these cases, it would also remove the necessity of filing additional paperwork down the road, which would remove both time and cost burdens for many tenants. Such mandatory expungements would include situations where the case is dismissed, such as the tenant prevails, the landlord's case is deemed by the court to be without basis in fact or law, the parties agree to a settlement and the terms of the settlement are met, or if the eviction is more than 3 years old. Eviction records are one of the first things landlords check for prospective tenants and are one of the leading causes of housing insecurity in our state. By preventing eviction records from being public until the tenant actually loses the case and expanding tenants' ability to get past evictions expunged, you can mitigate the housing instability issues facing many Minnesotan tenants. For these reasons, we urge you to support House File 835 with regard to both pre-eviction notice and expungement reform. Thank you, Chair Hausman and members of this committee.
Thank you, Ms. DeGrazia. And now we are joined by Nancy Etzweiler from the Volunteer Lawyers Network. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Etzweiler, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today in support of HS 835. I'm a retired...
Just a second. Do we need more volume for her? Can everyone hear? Maybe it's just me. Proceed.
Okay, thank you. I'm a retired corporate lawyer, and I volunteer now with Volunteer Lawyers Network. Volunteer Lawyers Network represents low-income landlords and tenants seeking legal advice and representation in housing matters. And through Volunteer Lawyers Network, I have represented dozens of clients, individuals, and families in housing court over the years seeking to expunge their eviction records. In support of the bill, I want to offer my perspective on the impact of the current statutes through the eyes of my clients. As we've heard, you know, eviction records are commenced when a landlord files a case and not after a landlord has proven its case and prevails. And so because there are currently no statutory provisions for automatic expungement, even when the tenant wins, or the tenant amicably settles with the landlord, or even when there's no hearing that occurs, there's also because there's no automatic sunsetting of the public's access to the records, and there's no guaranteed right to legal advice. I have clients whose families are rendered homeless and unable to find housing for years because of these old eviction records, including tenants, again, who won, who never had a hearing, were never served, or where the case was dismissed. I want to share just one example this morning so that we can sort of put a face on the impact of the statutes today. I have a client, Alani, not her real name. She's a mother of two girls, and she was a tenant that most landlords would love to have. With three different landlords over time, she consistently paid her rent, took good care of the property. She eventually then rented an apartment with her sister, again for months, paying rent on time, taking excellent care of the property. And after 16 months, the landlord granted her formal request to remove her name from the lease because she wanted to move out. There were some security issues at the site. Nonetheless, after she moved out and her name was removed from the lease, the landlord included her name in the eviction filing that he later filed with her sister when the sister defaulted on the rent. Not only was she not on the lease, she was not legally served, and she actually had no idea there was an eviction record out there with her name on it until she started to apply for rental property for herself and her daughters. So despite her glowing references from previous landlords, her rental applications were repeatedly rejected. In fact, she reached a point where she could no longer even afford to apply for rent because of the cost of the rental fees. She was forced with her daughters to live in shelters and then jump from friends' couches to friends' couches, and eventually found somebody who would just rent two small rooms in their house to her at an exorbitant rate. And the location of the house was far from her work. She actually struggled to kind of keep her job. And perhaps even more sobering, she had to make the decision about whether she would remove her daughter, particularly her young teen daughter, from her school in a supportive environment across town. She made the difficult choice to allow her young teen daughter to ride a public bus for 2 hours each day, sometimes in the dark in winter, so she could attend her school with her friends and the teachers that supported her. And this is a choice, I might add, that every single family I've represented except one has actually had to face. Had Alani had legal counsel from the beginning, I have no doubt the case would have been dismissed against her and her name expunged from the record, and her family would not have had to try to survive under these circumstances. She lived for years with panic and hopelessness day in and day out, wondering whether she'd actually ever be able to find a home again. And I've had many, many clients with comparable stories, and I've shared some of those in my written testimony. In closing, I just want to say, with today's tight, low-income rental market, instead of considering an eviction record as only one factor in an entire rental application, many landlords today look no farther than the eviction record to reject an application out of hand without understanding the underlying legal and factual circumstances of the case, and sometimes looking to see whether a hearing was ever held, whether the landlord actually prevailed. So we have some out-of-date eviction laws here, keeping low-income families out of stable homes and instead pushing them back to couch hopping, living in shelters, or simply living out on the street. And perhaps even worse, our out-of-state laws today create a second-class population that's forced to rent from slum landlords, often who rent only at inflated rates and maintain poorly kept properties. And it continues a cycle of exploitation and marginalization. So I would respectfully ask you to pass H.R. 835 and move Minnesota's eviction statutes to a place where they really reflect our housing market today and address the current statute's unintended tragic consequences on a lot of our tenants. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Etzweiler. And now our final testifier is Lucretia Brewer, who is a tenant. And I want to welcome you to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Alice Hausman. My name is Lucretia Brewer, and I live in Newport, Minnesota. I have been under the threat of being evicted since October 2021. Let me be clear, I did nothing to precipitate this action. I have lived at Wings of Newport since December 2020. Most of the residents in the 200-unit assisted living facility are there with a CADI waiver, which is Community Access for Disability Inclusion. In October of 2021, the landlord gave 3/4 of the building a notice to vacate so he could refurbish a $20 million complex opened in the fall of 2020, just barely a year later. I believe he wanted to throw us out and evict us so he could rent the apartment at a higher rent. On that notice, my landlord stated he would evict me if I wasn't out within 30 days. Most renters are vulnerable adults and couldn't find an appropriate place to live on such a short timeline. Several individuals were so scared of eviction that they abandoned all of their belongings and went to homeless shelters. A group of tenants, including myself, tried to negotiate with our landlord for more time, so I am still in the building while I search for a new apartment. But I am still scared every day that I might wake up to an eviction notice. My rental record is clear, but I am terrified of having an eviction notice on my record. Putting an eviction on someone's record should be done only as a last resort. Once that eviction is put on your record, it is almost impossible to rent, throwing that person or family into chaos and financial crisis. Expungement reform is important for so many reasons. It only seems fair and just that eviction notices show up on your record only after the judge has heard from both sides. It's very important the courts make expungement easier to access. As I have experienced firsthand, an eviction doesn't always accurately represent if you are a good tenant or not. Even if you have paid your rent on time for years, missing just one payment, no matter the reason, can get you evicted. Evictions more than 3 years old should be expunged because everyone should get a second chance to improve their record. Landlords should also be required to notify tenants before filing an eviction. That would give the tenant and landlord the chance to communicate, and maybe they could come up with a plan to settle the problem. This would be advantageous financially to both the landlord and the tenant. Thank you for taking the time to listen to my concerns today on issues that affect me, but more importantly, affect the many who are not able to advocate for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brewer, for sharing your story. We are grateful. Members, questions for the testifiers or the bill author? I see no hands. Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question, but rather a comment. As someone who represents a district that's over 80% renters and who has dedicated the last 4 years, I've been in the legislature advocating for tenant rights. It's no surprise that I support all of these bills. According to research, evictions cause large and persistent increases in risk of homelessness, elevate long-term residential instability, and increase emergency room use, not to mention the impact affecting a family has on the children's education. BIPOC single mothers have the highest risk of being evicted and are some of the reasons why our shelters are overflowing. Evictions pose a significant barrier to accessing and maintaining stable housing for many BIPOC communities and urban communities. If we truly believe housing is a human rights issue and everyone deserves a stable place to call home, then we must do everything possible to make sure our eviction laws are reformed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. I see no other hands. Representative Herr, final comments on the bill. Oh, there's another hand up. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, I can't multitask and read and press raise hand things at the same time. I'm sorry about that. I'm concerned about this bill as I was the last time we heard it. I remember that the human rights provision were taken out in, they were included in the House Judiciary bill, but then they were taken out in conference committee. Do you think you've got that'll change this year, or are we probably going to see the same thing this year? What do you think? I mean, are we going to see it go through? Because I do have concerns about that part of it.
Representative Herr, do you have, since you've seen this through in judiciary, do you have a comment or opinion? I'm guessing because tenant protections have been sort of an uphill battle for several years that would continue to be the case. But Representative Herr, any thoughts?
Thank you, Chair Houseman, and thank you, Representative Tice, for the question. Can you just help clarify for me when you talk about the human rights, what specific provision are you referring to? Are you talking about like a certain part of the bill?
Sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Herr, I think if I remember correctly, the human rights provisions, so that whole part of it was not included in an omnibus bill that was taken out in judiciary. And I'm just wondering if you think it has a better chance this year.
Chair Houseman, Representative, I guess, are you referring to like the source of income protection part I'm a little bit confused, and maybe our lawyer on the call, Ms. Leah DeGrazia, can chime in and help me understand maybe what portion Representative Tice is referring to, because the only thing I can think of is the source of income has discrimination piece in it, and that might be what you're referring to. That might.
Do any of the testifiers? I think you had specifically wondered if Ms. DeGrazia might have a comment.
Yeah, Chair Houseman, Representative Herr, and Representative Tice. I also am not sure which specific provision is being referenced. I'm sorry.
This bill is being laid over, and so maybe we can still have some conversation about this, because it's, you know, at this point we don't have a path for this yet. So
okay.
And Chair Houseman, I just maybe would like to add that, Representative, I would love to talk with you offline, because I know you always have really great thoughts, and you know, and so I want to hear what maybe was the specific part you're referring to, because I think that the part that might have the most applicable area you're speaking to is the source of income discrimination, which does, have more ties directly to the discrimination and human rights. And so I want to make sure that we're talking about the same things, and I can get you good answers for that. So I'd love to talk with you offline, but I think that maybe one of our testifiers, Michael Dahl, might have the last comment about this particular
piece. Okay, Mr. Dahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Tice, I believe that the reason the source of income money was, our source of income portion is taken off is because it has an expense with the Department of Human Rights and therefore has to be dealt with in judiciary's budget.
So the cost, you're saying?
Correct.
I see no other, Representative Tice, did that conclude your questions?
I just wanted to, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make another a comment.
Okay.
When I read through some of this stuff, my husband and I have done this for years. When we've had to write letters with the information that you're asking, and I see that being done already. And it was not, I basically made a template for a letter, and it was just, you know, we had all the information there. I just filled in that tenant's information. I think a lot of us already do this. And again, I will say a large part of why I'm very skeptical about a lot of these bills, and I think the other three of yours are probably a little bit here too, is how do we keep people engaged without putting too much burden on them to the point where they're saying, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. For us, again, it was not our main business. It was something we did because we were in housing, and it was a part of what we did as we took a lot of homes in the late, even the mid 2000s, 2009, 10, 11, 12, and got them up to speed where they would be more efficient. And I think a lot of people got into it for those reasons, and to have the housing available. And I will tell you, with some of the rent control things and some of the other bills we're coming up with, again, I'm just concerned that a lot of folks are going to just say the heck with it and be done with it. And I'm wondering who's going to buy the single family homes, buy the duplexes and such, so that we can keep on going. I just want to make sure that we do it in a way that we're not just making them bad landlords or slum landlords, that we're looking at them, that people that want to do the right thing and help. We've done it for years. As I said, most of the folks that we have in our five homes have been there for, four of them have been there since we bought the house, or three of them have been there since we bought the house, and the other two kind of go a little bit more. But the folks I talk to are all pretty much on the same page I am, that we want to keep the properties going. We want to do it in a way that isn't going to be egregious, and I don't have to put a lot more money in. So sometimes I'm very leery of what this could do to the current market and the owners that will probably just throw their hands up and say, I'm done. With that, thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing these bills forward. I think a lot of this has to be said, needs to be said, but I don't always agree with the language that you have. Thank you.
I see no other hands up. Representative Herr, do you have final comments on the bill?
Thank you, Chair Houseman, and thank you, Representative Tice, for your comments. I think I'll just repeat, like I said at the beginning of the testimony, that most landlords do work with their tenants, and I've said this before on our specific housing committees, that we have good landlords like Representative Tice, but that's not who these laws are made for, and if they're already following the rules, then this does not impact them. And I want to state that, like, they're, you know, I want to keep those small landlords continuing to have their properties available, but, you know, we're really protecting individuals who, you know, against what A.G. Ellison, the lawsuit that was filed, and he's working on right now in February of 2020, where that landlord owned 600 units, right? And, like, they're, you know, these are the types of landlords that we want to make sure that people are protected from, and they have the greatest reach on, you know, the number of people that are impacted when landlords do not do a good job of working with their tenants, and they're not invested in ensuring that their properties are well maintained or that they have good communications with the tenants. And so this is why this is needed. And those are the individuals who need this protection. And so I just want to ask that, you know, the committee continue to be welcome to this type of bill and this protection. And I renew my motion that it does get included for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Herr. House File 835 is laid over. The next bill on the agenda is House File 398. Representative Herr, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 398 to be referred to the General Registry.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. And before us is House File 398. This is a bill that addresses three issues pertaining to heat and repairs. Minnesota renters deserve to live in a home that is warm. If they don't control the thermostat, their home should be heated to 68 degrees from October 1st to April 30th, wherever they live in the state. This bill proposes a statewide heat code. Additionally, this bill proposes that more housing issues be considered emergency repairs needed. Needs. While Homeline testifiers will go through the details, I think that it is really important for us to remember that things like a broken refrigerator or non-working elevators rise to the level of emergency repairs. Finally, it currently costs tenants roughly $300 to file a court case concerning emergency repairs. That is simply too costly a burden to place on households living paycheck to paycheck. Reducing this fee to $70 brings this filing in line with conciliation or small claims court. With that, Madam Chair, I do have testifiers here to speak on behalf of the bill.
Thank you. I have one testifier, Leah DiGrazio, from Homeline. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you, Chair Houseman. My name is Leah DiGrazio. I'm from Homeline. House File 398 is an umbrella bill covering heat and emergency repairs. It's no secret that Minnesota is cold. Sub-zero temperatures are not considered unusual, with wind chill temperatures often sinking much lower. Cold indoor temperature is especially dangerous for elderly people, young children, and anyone with health problems. The risk of fire also increases in the winter because many Minnesota tenants report relying on alternative heating sources during the winter months, such as space heaters or even ovens. Under the current law, there is no statewide requirement that landlords maintain a rental unit at any specific temperature. Some cities have ordinances requiring a certain temperature be maintained. Many other cities simply require that the building's heating system is capable of maintaining a temperature of 68 degrees, but don't actually require that a landlord keep the building that warm. Still others have no heating or building code protections for renters whatsoever. Instead of having a patchwork of different rules, which can vary substantially from city to city in terms of both content and enforceability, House File 398 creates a statewide requirement guaranteeing that a tenant has a right to a minimum temperature during the cold weather months. This language would mirror the more protective local ordinances, such as Worthington, which requires that a landlord maintain a temperature of 68 degrees in all rental units. Compare this to Wilmer, which requires that heating equipment be able to maintain 68 degrees, but that habitable rooms only be kept at a temperature of 65 degrees. Uniformity across a state that experiences severe winter weather will be an important protection for all tenants. The second important part of House File 398 is its provision about emergency repairs. Under the current law, most repair issues brought by tenants go through what is called the rent escrow process. This process usually takes, at minimum, 28 days before repair issues are heard in court, and often even longer to have the actual repairs completed. Fortunately, tenants are able to file an expedited case in court for issues that are considered an emergency. These expedited cases, called Emergency Tenant Remedies Actions, or ETRA, require that the tenant give the landlord 24-hour notice of the issue before pursuing relief from the court. The scope of issues that constitute an emergency is narrow, including only, quote, loss of running water, hot water, heat, electricity, sanitary facilities, or other essential services. This proposed law would expand the list of issues that can be considered emergencies. By delineating what issues are permissible in ETRAs, this law would more clearly give instruction to tenants, landlords, and to courts. Specifically, this proposed law includes the loss of a working refrigerator, a serious infestation, and loss of air conditioning or elevator if promised in the lease. In addition to the narrow and ambiguous scope of qualifying ETRA issues, the filing fee for an ETRA costs the tenant about $300. In comparison, right now it costs only $70 to $80 to file for rent escrow. This higher amount seems grossly unfair when one considers the fact that ETRA cases are about emergencies, a loss of essential services or facilities that the landlord has promised to both provide and maintain. Similarly, tenants whose landlords commit illegal lockouts must also pay a $300 filing fee to get their day in court. Illegal lockouts refer to when a landlord or their agent unlawfully and in bad faith removes, excludes, or forcibly keeps out a tenant from a residential premises, of which the tenant should otherwise have legal possession. This proposed law lowers the cost of the filing fee for both ETRAs and lockout actions to mirror the cost of rent escrow actions. Specifically, this law proposes to set the filing fee at the same rate as conciliation court in order to lower the financial barrier faced by many tenants seeking to address an emergency issue. Adopting this law to clarify what constitutes adequate heat and/or an emergency repair will ultimately create uniformity and clarity for both landlords and tenants, as well as making it easier for tenants who are facing emergency situations to advocate for their rights. We urge you to support House File 398. Thank you, Chair Hausman and members of this committee.
Thank you, Ms. DeGracia. Representative Hur, that's the only name I had as a testifier for this particular bill. Is that correct? Okay. So members, questions for the testifier or the bill author? I see no hands going up. Mr. Worth, I'm assuming you'll always let me know if I'm missing anybody. No questions. Representative Hur, final comments on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just that I ask for the committee's support and that I renew my motion to, for House File 398 be referred to the General Register.
Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll.
Chair Hausman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Howard.
Aye.
Representative Tice?
No.
Representative Agbaje?
Aye.
Representative Bliss?
No.
Representative Gomez?
Gomez, aye.
Representative Hassan?
Hassan, aye.
Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, no.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Juergens?
Juergens, no.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Barr?
Barr, no.
Representative Ryer?
Aye.
Madam Chair, we have 8 ayes and 5 nays.
There being 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed. The next bill on the agenda is House File 399. Representative Herr, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the House File 399 be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. This House File 399 deals with two issues: fees for non-optional services and privacy. An increasing number of landlords charge a non-refundable fee, charge non-refundable fees for non-optional services rather than including the cost in the advertised rent. As you'll soon see, some leases include bizarre fees like move-in fees, and even more unbelievable, one large landlord charged a January fee. No explanation of what that means except for just that it was January. Regarding privacy, the current statute uses the subjective term of reasonable notice for how much advance notice a landlord must provide before entering a tenant's home for non-emergency issues. The subjectivity leads to some serious violations of renters' privacy. And I just, we'll probably get into this discussion, but I just want to be very clear. This does not change when a tenant and a landlord agrees when a landlord would be coming in, especially if in situations like an emergency when they need to get in right away. So there is still the option for all of those. It's just that for non-emergency issues, the landlord must provide a notice before entering that tenant's home. And so I do have two testifiers here for House File 399, and I will turn it over to our testifiers.
We do have two testifiers. Leah DiGrazio from Homeline is the first one up. Welcome again.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. I'm Leah DiGrazio. House File 399 addresses two issues that hinge on lease fairness and business transparency: non-optional fees and a tenant's right to privacy. First, with regard to fees, an increasing number of landlords impose non-optional fees for non-optional services. This is different from a pet fee or a parking fee that a tenant may elect to add to their monthly costs. These fees include move-in or move-out fees, vague administrative fees, lease processing fees, fees to access the rental portal to pay rent, and in one case, even a mystery January fee of $100, presumably just because it's January. Though included in the lease language, these fees are rarely transparently included in the advertised rent. This means that landlords are able to draw in potential tenants with a deceptively advertised rent amount and then effectively raise the rental cost of a given property by means of these non-optional fees. Because these fees are only revealed once a tenant has the lease in hand, many tenants are not aware of the additional fees until late in the application process, often after they have paid the application fee or even signed the lease. House File 399 would prohibit non-optional fees for non-optional services. In practice, this means that all non-optional costs associated with renting a given property must be incorporated in the total price of rent. This will ensure that any administrative, rent, service, or other costs are transparently presented as the tenant's cost to rent the property, thereby allowing tenants to understand how much they will need to actually pay each month before entering a given lease. This in turn will mean that tenants will not face unaffordable concealed charges after applying for a unit or signing a lease. Ultimately, this does not prevent landlords from charging what they need in order to cover the costs of running their business. This bill solely requires that the true cost of a given property is communicated from the get-go, and that tenants do not need to worry about hidden fees when establishing their rental budget. Next, with regard to a tenant's right to privacy, House File 399 would clarify the requirements a landlord must meet in order to enter a tenant's home without permission. There is no debate that there are instances where a landlord must enter a rental unit, be it to make repairs, conduct inspections, or offer showings to new prospective tenants. However, the reality is that when a residential tenant rents a property, the tenant becomes the party who has legal possession of that property. And more importantly, this property becomes their home. A person should be able to expect privacy in their own homes. Under current Minnesota law, a landlord need only give reasonable notice before entering a rental property for a business purpose. What constitutes reasonable is undefined in our current law and is thus left up to landlord's interpretation. Furthermore, current law lists no parameters for how a landlord must give this notice, nor what hours of the day a landlord may enter a rental unit after giving such reasonable notice. Many tenants are therefore uncertain about what type of privacy rights they have and find that they do not have the level of privacy in their homes that they deserve. The manifestations of these privacy issues vary, which is expected given the vague wording of the current law. I have personally worked with tenants whose landlords enter their property after only giving an hour's notice without waiting for confirmation from the tenant, which has led to tenants in the bathroom or shower being surprised by their landlords. Some landlords don't give any notice at all. Other tenants have experienced their landlords entering at bizarre hours, such as early in the morning when tenants are still sleeping, or late at night, which disrupt many tenants' routines. Still other tenants report that their landlords will give a wide window of when the tenant should expect the landlord to enter, meaning the tenant must halt their own plans for the day to accommodate the landlord's schedule. These tenants who suffer these privacy violations have little recourse. Minnesota law allows only a $100 penalty per violation. After paying filing fees and accounting for time and effort, this negligible penalty is hardly meaningful, and most tenants do not pursue it. House File 399 would have Minnesota follow the lead of at least 28 other states and clarify its privacy law. Specifically, the proposed law defines reasonable notice as at least 24 hours prior to entering without permission. The proposed law would also require the landlord to give a four-hour window of when they plan to enter, with this window only being between the hours of 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Finally, if this right to privacy is violated, tenants can pursue a meaningful civil penalty of the equivalent of 1 month's rent plus reasonable attorney's fees. While this law will not limit a landlord's ability to charge what they need, nor to enter a tenant's home when necessary, House File 399 will ensure that these practices are transparent and therefore more fair to tenants. We encourage you to support House File 399. Thank you, Chair Hausman, and members of this committee.
Thank you. And we are joined now by Erica Staub from the Hope Center. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Do we have somebody who needs to be unmuted? Do we see Mr. Wirth? Do we see her on the screen?
Yes, Madam Chair, she is here, but we can't catch her audio. Ms. Staub, we still can't hear what you're saying.
One of the downsides of working remotely. there she is.
Can you hear me?
Yes, welcome.
I apologize. I've got different things happening. So my name is Erica Staub-Adcher, and I'm the director of Hope Center here in Rice County. So thank you, Chair Hausman and members of the committee, for allowing me to come to present today. I'm the executive director of Hope Center, which is a small domestic violence and sexual assault agency in Rice County in southern Minnesota. I wanted to share a few of the stories that have been shared with me as to why this bill, in particular, the provisions around privacy are so important and can be so helpful to the clients we serve and to the state of Minnesota. After spending the past 25 years working with domestic and sexual violence victims, one of the things that's clear to me is that the impact of these traumas do not end when the relationship ends or when the assault is over. Anywhere between 41 to 88% of the 1,200 clients that we see each year just in Rice County live with trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, ongoing trust issues, and hypervigilance long after the assault. Outside of seeking support with advocacy organizations and therapy, one of the most important things is for people to have a safe haven, a sacred place to heal, restore, and to have their own sanctuary. We have calls after people who move out who send us pictures of a virtually empty apartment with the text saying, "I've never been happier. I can finally sleep at night because I feel safe." So imagine how it feels to be napping on the couch after working a late night shift at night to have a well-meaning maintenance guy who's just in the room next door bang on the door just to come check on something because I was already here, so I thought I'd take care of things. Now, although there was no malice involved, immediately this threw my particular client into a panic attack. She had a history of child sexual abuse and domestic violence. No man in her life had ever listened to her no. In her experience, no man in her life was safe, much less a man that came to the door with weapons. Now, to those of us who haven't experienced post-traumatic stress disorder or extensive abuse, we would just see a toolbox. But to her, she saw all the things that could be used as weapons if she didn't comply with what he had asked. She called us immediately after he left, still in a panic, and we had to talk her down. She ended up having to go back to her therapist. It was a horrible event for her. We also have had people call us in tears that they no longer felt safe in their apartment because while they were away at work or school, they came back to a note from their landlord saying they were in the apartment to check on something. Immediately, they start flashing back to their abuser and the cameras that they had put in their room without permission, the flowers that were left on the table from their abusive ex, in spite of the restraining order, and all of the times that their boundaries had been violated and the space not respected as their own. Another client we had eventually left an apartment because her landlord just simply enjoyed making her uncomfortable. He'd make comments on things in her apartment when they met in the hallway that made it clear that he had been in there without her permission or notice. Had she had provisions like this, had she known exactly what the rules were, she would have felt more comfortable asserting her rights, and we would have been able to assist her more fully in helping her if the laws had been more clear and less open to interpretation. Also, the addition of the time frame is so absolutely essential. Many of our clients have experienced violations of trust after dark. By giving a time frame, this also helps make it less traumatizing to have someone demanding to come into your apartment at 10 p.m. when it's dark out, your children are asleep, and you're a single mom trying to wind down for the evening. With rental housing in rural areas at 1 to 3% vacancy rates, my client felt like she had no recourse but to comply with what his demands were. The clarity and boundaries of the time frame can give our clients control back over their lives and their homes. Some clients want that time to be able to leave the apartment and not be there when strangers are there. Some clients want to be there as a part of their own healing and a part of their own taking back of their control of their lives. This would give them the chance to make an informed decision and not one that is made out of fear or the immediacy of the moment. Each year, we work with many clients on landlord issues, many of them related to the lack of boundaries, the lack of respect, and the invasion of privacy concerns that this simple legislative fix could address. For my client, abusers have taken away their privacy, their control, and their consent. This is an easy way to be able to afford them the dignity and respect that they deserve. Thank you so much for your time and attention, and also I apologize for the technical difficulties. I would love to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Well, I'm so grateful we were able to fix that technical problem because that was an important point to be made on this particular bill. Members, questions for the testifiers or the bill author? I'll give it just a little bit of time in case anybody's having difficulty. It looks like no hands are going up. Representative Herr, was that one? No. Representative Herr, final comments on the bill.
Thank you, Chair Hausman, and thank you, committee, for hearing House Bill 399. These particular pieces that we're addressing today are really critical, especially for individuals who are on very tight budgets who are trying to secure housing so that they know all the fees that they will be paying when they do sign up and apply for, be able to live in a unit. And also privacy is a very, whether somebody owns a unit or lives in a unit or is renting it, it is their home and that they should be able to have the privacy needed within those homes. And so I asked for the committee to support this bill and that I renew my motion for House Bill 399 be referred to the General Register.
Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll.
Chair Houseman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Howard.
Aye.
Representative Tice?
No.
Representative Egbaje?
Aye.
Representative Bliss?
No.
Representative Gomez?
Gomez, aye.
Representative Hassan?
Hassan Phillips, aye.
Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, no.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Juergens?
Juergens, no.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
No.
And Representative Ryer?
Aye.
Madam Chair, we have 8 ayes and 5 nays.
There being 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed. And finally, the next bill on the agenda is House File 400. Representative Farr, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that House File 400 be re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. House File, and I'm hoping I'll have better luck at this one because we have passed this out of Judiciary and Housing with bipartisan support. So thank you for hearing House File 400. This bill is very simple and it's very necessary. It allows renters to break their lease with ample notice if a physician-certified condition, illness, or disability makes living in their current housing a health issue. This bill has been in the works for a while. What is in this bill is compromised language between the advocate groups and entities that proposed it initially. A lot of work has gone into this bill. And so, I do hope that all of you will support it. I do have Ms. DeGrazia here to testify. And so I can turn it over to her to speak about the bill in more detail.
Yes, again, we have Leah DeGrazia from Homeline. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Houseman and members of the committee. House File 400 allows tenants who have an illness or disability to break their lease in order to move into a medical care facility. This committee saw this bill last year and passed it with bipartisan support. Under the current Minnesota law, if a tenant becomes unable to use their rental unit due to a disability, illness, or medical condition, there is no explicit protection that lets them break their lease. I have personally spoken to a number of tenants who experienced unexpected illnesses or disabilities that required that they move to a medical care facility for their own safety and well-being. These tenants did not have any easy recourse, and I typically advise these tenants to try to negotiate an early termination with their landlord. While some landlords are amenable to negotiating early terminations due to infirmity, I can verify that this is not always the case. If the landlords think they can re-rent the rental unit quickly, they may allow their tenant to break their lease. If not, the landlord has full legal license to simply refuse to let the tenant out of their lease, forcing the tenant into a difficult position. I've personally worked with tenants who incurred exorbitant early termination fees because their desperate need to move into a medical facility drastically mitigated their negotiating power. I've also seen tenants whose credit was destroyed because their names were submitted to collections when their landlords refused to terminate the lease and also refused to try to re-rent the unit, even after the tenant vacated and moved into assisted living as needed. In addition to the financial harm that might come with this situation, individuals facing such circumstances may end up making decisions about their healthcare and housing options that are not in their best interest, nor helpful for their support network of friends and family. House File 400 offers a reasonable and balanced solution to this problem. Under HF 400, tenants could only break their lease if they have a medical professional verify in writing that the tenant has a condition which warrants breaking the lease because the tenant needs to move into a medical care facility. The statute defines medical care facility as a nursing home, hospice care, boarding care, supervised living facility or assisted living facility, an accessible unit, or a facility providing intensive residential rehabilitative mental health treatment. A tenant intending to follow this proposed law is required to give a written 2-month notice in advance, providing the landlord ample time to market the unit and re-rent it to a new tenant. The 2-month notice mirrors other Minnesota law, which allows the estate of a deceased tenant to terminate the lease with 60 days written notice. It is important to note that this bill is not trying to create an easy way for tenants to simply duck out of their lease contract responsibilities. Rather, it would provide a legal, defined method for tenants to get out of their lease when a medical condition makes it impossible to continue living in their home. This bill is necessary in order to create a procedure for those affected by severe infirmity to terminate their leases and get their needed medical care, while still protecting landlords' interest in receiving proper notice and the ability to re-rent. Homeline urges you to support House File 400. Thank you, Chair Houseman, members of the committee.
Thank you. Members, questions for the testifier or the bill author? I see no hands going. Representative Price.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate your patience. And this question is for Representative Herr. In Judiciary, Representative Scott offered an amendment, and I was just wondering if you'd given it any more consideration. Basically, what it says that the medical profession believes the infirmary will require the tenant to stay at a medical care facility for at least 90 days. Have you changed your mind, or what was your thinking behind this one? Thank you.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Hausman, and thank you, Representative Tice, for the question. So the reason why I didn't accept the amendment in Judiciary is that the process in place already requires, I think it was like, and maybe Ms. DeGrazia can confirm this for me, but there was already 2 months of like notice ahead of time and the amount of paperwork that it was required. And I think that part of the reason why that amendment was put through was to ensure that, the landlords had proper notice. And so I just wanted to make sure, we looked at it and looked at the requirements already and what it takes for a tenant in order to get that doctor's notice, in order to get the information they need, in order to get the notice to the tenant, to the landlord, that those processes in place already, gave sufficient time to ensure that a tenant wasn't just trying to get out of their lease. And so I would let Ms. DeGrazia comment further on that.
Ms. DeGrazia.
Thank you, Chair Hausman. Thank you, Representative Tice, for that question. I think it is an important thing to think about, because the idea is that, really this is a conversation between a person with a disability or infirmity that is verified by a medical professional. And to require that they are going to be staying somewhere for 90 days at minimum is just not always a realistic thing to require. They may be staying there, they may not. And really, at the end of the day, that really is between the medical professional and the client, the patient, really. What protects landlords in this situation is the 60-day notice, because this isn't someone who's going to just go to a 2-week intensive program and bail on the last 8 months of their lease. They have to pay for those 2 full months of their lease. And so it really wouldn't make very much sense unless they had a very legitimate need for someone to be on the hook for those 2 months of rent and, only be gone for like a 1-week program. This really isn't designed for people to leave their leases without penalty, because there is that 60-day notice requirement. And I do want to, again, bring your attention to the fact that this same format is what we have already in the termination for a death of a tenant, and which, I also think makes sense. So it's worked very well in that format, and I think it would work really well here too.
Representative Tice, follow up?
No, I don't. Thank you, Mrs. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hausman.
I see other hands. Seeing no other raised, Representative Herr, final comments on the bill.
Thank you, Chair Hausman. And before I make final comments on this bill, I did just want to say that I don't think that I acknowledge the fact that on House File 835, Representative Hassan was the original author of 2 of the provisions within that bill as standalone bills. And I just wanted to give due respect to Representative Hassan for the work that she put into that and for continued efforts to fight for tenants and their and protection of their rights. And so I wanted to say that, first of all. And secondly, I just want to say that I really appreciate all the work that has gone into this bill and the amount of individuals who have been involved and the compromises that have been made. I appreciate the continued looking at the language and providing language in which might strengthen the bill further. And though I did not accept Representative Scott's amendment, I think that we are in a good place with this bill. And I hope that this committee, I would ask for this committee support, and I renew my motion that House File 400 be referred to the General Register.
Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll.
Chair Hausman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Howard.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative Egbaje.
Aye.
Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Hassan votes aye.
Representative Heinrich.
Heinrich, aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Juergens.
Juergens votes aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
And Representative Ryer.
Aye. Sorry.
Okay. Madam Chair, we have 13 ayes and zero nays.
There being 13 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed. Members, thank you so much for helping us move through four bills in a very speedy way today. We appreciate the attention. I see no other hands or comments. Members, our next meeting will be on Tuesday, March 8th. There being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.